I'm John Strum, and this is Real Talk MS. It's October 31st, and we have a lot to talk about. Women living with MS face additional challenges related to family planning, pregnancy, and menopause, all while dealing with the ongoing challenge of just managing their MS. This state of affairs is even more pronounced when you stop to consider that compared to men, women are three times more likely to have MS. Rachel Horn is a journalist who was diagnosed with MS in 2009, so she has a first-hand understanding of the knowledge gaps that remain when it comes to understanding the impact of MS on women's health and the impact of women's health issues on MS. And as she reviewed MS research, Rachel also observed that when it came to acknowledging outstanding MS research, it was rare that a female researcher was singled out to receive awards for their work. And so this year, Rachel took action and did something about it when she established the Rachel Horn Prize for Women's Research in MS, awarded by the International Women in MS, in recognition of outstanding contributions to research and understanding and treatment of women's specific health issues in MS. I met up with Rachel Horn a few weeks ago at the joint ECTRIMS-ACTRIMS meeting in Milan, and we were joined by the first recipient of this annual award, Dr. Rhonda Vascul. Dr. Vascul is a neurologist, research scientist, and clinician at the University of California, Los Angeles, where she's a professor of neurology, the Jack H. Skirball Chair for Multiple Sclerosis Research, and the director of the UCLA Multiple Sclerosis Program. I had an opportunity to talk with Rachel about the Rachel Horn Prize for Women's Research in MS, and I had a chance to talk with Dr. Vascul about some of her groundbreaking research into how or why MS impacts men and women differently. But before we get to my conversation with Rachel Horn and Dr. Rhonda Vascul, there are a few other things that you should know about. We first started talking about foralumab on this podcast in 2021, when the first person with secondary progressive MS began treatment under a special one-off program offered by the FDA called the Individual Expanded Access Program. This program is sometimes referred to as compassionate use, when an investigational treatment is administered outside of a clinical trial as a response to an immediately life-threatening condition or serious disease. Foralumab is an immune-modulating antibody that's administered by means of a nasal spray, and it works by targeting a specific protein in T cells to calm the immune response. In people living with MS, that immune response is what leads to demyelination and disease worsening. Well, a couple of weeks ago at the 2023 joint ECTRIMS-ACTRIMS meeting, Tiziana Life Sciences, the company that's developing foralumab, reported that 6 months of treatment with foralumab led to decreases in microglial activity for 5 out of 6 people with non-active secondary progressive MS who were receiving the treatment through that expanded access program. Now, in MS, microglial activity is directly associated with inflammation, and non-relapsing types of MS, like non-active secondary progressive MS, haven't been responsive to most available therapies. To identify a therapy that has an effect on microglial activity among people with non-active secondary progressive MS would be a great step forward in providing effective therapies for everyone living with MS. And the fact that this therapy is administered at home by means of a nasal spray makes it especially user-friendly. Tiziana Life Sciences is currently identifying several sites for a planned Phase 2A clinical trial to continue investigating foralumab, and will continue to keep you posted on their progress. If you've been catching the ECTRIMS Extra conversations that I released last week, And if you haven't, you may want to check out the 5 short conversations I had with some of the top research and clinical experts in the world. Well, you may recall my conversation with Dr. Daniel Antoneta about the role of artificial intelligence in MS. If you missed any of those conversations, you'll find the links in today's show notes. But over the next few years, AI will impact almost every aspect of science and medicine, from laboratory discovery to clinical trials to clinical practice. And one of the ways that artificial intelligence can improve treating and monitoring MS is by using a form of artificial intelligence called machine learning to see more detail in MRI scans than the human eye can process. There's a well-known story about a NASA engineer who used machine learning to train a computer to spot patterns in space by having it look at thousands and thousands of photos taken by NASA satellites. Once the computer had trained itself, it found 2 planets in distant galaxies. Now, these were planets that NASA hadn't yet discovered. Neurologists won't be looking for planets, but machine learning is already enabling computers to spot patterns in MRI scans and identify lesions that are too small to be spotted by radiologists, and to more accurately measure subtle changes in brain volume before they become apparent. Better tools lead to earlier treatment, and early treatment leads to better patient outcomes. Over the coming weeks, months, and years, you can expect to hear about more ways that AI tools are changing the practice of medicine and improving MS research and treatment. Obesity is a known risk factor for developing MS, but less is known about the impact of obesity on the course of the disease after diagnosis. An analysis of data from Sweden that was presented at the recent 2023 joint ECTRIMS-ACTRIMS meeting sheds some additional light on how obesity may impact MS. The data that was analyzed came from 3,249 people living with MS who were followed for up to 15 years after their diagnosis through the Swedish MS Registry, where they were monitored for changes in disability, quality of life, and cognition. Obesity was determined based on body mass index, or BMI, which is an indicator of body fat based on height and weight. Normal BMI ranges between 18.5 to 24.99. A BMI between 25 and 30 is considered overweight, and anything over 30 is considered obese. Disability progression was monitored using the Expanded Disability Status Scale, or EDSS. And as a reminder, EDSS is the method that neurologists use to quantify disability in MS. It uses a scoring system of between 0 and 10 to characterize the level of disability in someone living with MS. After taking factors like age, sex, disease type, disease duration, level of disability, disease-modifying therapies, and smoking all into account, the analysis of the data showed that obese MS patients had slightly faster disability progression compared to MS patients who were not obese. Obese MS patients had a 41% higher risk of reaching an EDSS score of 3, which typically characterizes a transition from mild to moderate disability. And they had a 31% higher risk of reaching an EDSS score of 4, which reflects significant disability without walking impairment. Obese MS patients had a 40% higher risk of physical worsening and a 24% higher risk of psychological worsening, as well as a significantly high risk of cognitive worsening. Losing weight isn't easy for anyone, but this analysis creates some fairly strong motivation for someone living with MS who may be obese. Without having to wait for the next pill, injection, or infusion, making some different lifestyle choices and losing weight can slow disability progression, improve overall quality of life, and maintain better cognitive health. If you'd like to review the details of this analysis, you'll find a link in today's show notes. In addition to all of the presentations and scientific sessions that took place at the 2023 joint ECTRIMS-ACTRIMS meeting in Milan, The meeting also served as a venue for presenting the first Rachel Horn Prize for Women's Research in MS. This was an important moment, and the very first recipient of this award couldn't be more deserving. In a moment, you'll hear my conversation with Rachel Horn and the 2023 recipient of the Rachel Horn Prize for Women's Research in MS, Dr. Rhonda Bascule. I'm at ECTRIMS 2023 in Milan, and I'm speaking with Rachel Horn. Rachel is a journalist who was diagnosed with MS in 2009, and she's the driving force behind establishing the Rachel Horn Prize for Women's Research in MS, awarded by the International Women in MS, in recognition of outstanding contributions to research in understanding and treatment of women-specific health issues in MS. Rachel, thanks for joining me today.
Oh, and thank you very much, John, for having me on. I'm a big, big fan.
What motivated you to establish the award?
Okay. I've been diagnosed with MS in 2009, done quite a bit of reading on it. I found that in many aspects, women are undervalued and often overlooked. And this is definitely true in the MS world. And despite the fact that the disease disproportionately, up to three times impacts women versus men. At the same time, we already know that there are research prizes for scientists in MS, but I noticed they were overwhelmingly rewarding and favoring male scientists. Let's take, for example, the Brancheck Award, which has been around for 10 years, and there's only been two sole winners, which were women. And then we take a look at the John Distill Award, which was set up in 1995. And so over the years, there's only been, again, two women have won, which is less than 7%. Another thing I did notice is that the women's health issues in MS, again, there's been significant gaps in the knowledge, what we know about, say, menstruation, family planning, pregnancy, menopause, sexual dysfunction. So I thought the one way to kind of loop these things in together was to create a prize which would reward a woman scientist and at the same time encourage more information, more research into these significant health issues. And I'll be honest with you, I think that in the end, it's not just altruistic. I'm hoping to benefit too. More scientists, more research. It's got to be good for all of us with MS.
So what's been the reaction to establishing the award?
I think it's been actually overwhelmingly positive. I was really thrilled when I came up with the idea in August of last year. And then immediately I reached out to the International Women in MS because no way I could have done it by myself. And they were able to, very quickly they came on board and said they're very happy to adjudicate the process. And also I think that ends, they will also, they've been able to add huge credibility and governance for that. At the same time, ECTRIMS and also ACTRIMS, very happy to partner here and give us a space and give us a platform. So all in all, I've been really thrilled.
Is this going to be an annual award?
Absolutely. I mean, this is the first year, but the short term, it's going to be recognizing those that have possibly been overlooked before. And then over the long-term process, hopefully it'll encourage women neurologists and neuroscientists in the field towards doing more research into women's health issues. And again, as I said, hopefully that will filter down to women with MS because there's 2 million of us in the world. And so they'll be able to learn more about better care and treatment of their disease.
So where can people go to find out more about the award?
They can go to rachelhornprize.com on there, and then certainly ECTRIMS, ACTRIMS, and also International Women in MS, they've also got information there. And then, of course, you can always go onto my Twitter, because I do tend to do updates, which is RachelHorn19.
And I'm a follower, and I will only say if people are not following you on Twitter, they should be.
Thank you very much. And I follow you. And congratulations, because I believe you just had your 6-year anniversary. So how many broadcasts have you done?
Episode number 319 is out this week.
Yeah. And thank you very much for all you do, because as somebody with MS, with a non-science background, I think you do an absolutely fantastic job of breaking down the studies, why they're important, why we should listen to them, and what we should ask. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you for those kind words. Let's switch gears for a minute. You are an author of a recently published paper entitled Medical Gaslighting in People with Multiple Sclerosis. That's an interesting subject. Can you tell us what medical gaslighting is?
Well, medical gaslighting, as very basic, is a behavior in which a healthcare professional dismisses, downplays, or blames a patient's symptoms or attributes them to a psychological condition.
Okay, I'm going to circle back to that in a minute, but let me ask you this first. In your paper, you described a survey of people living with MS. What did those survey results reveal to you?
Well, actually, Professor Gavin Giovannoni came up with the survey, and he managed to get responses from, I believe it was 424 patients with MS, and asked them if various questions, if they'd ever been gaslit, what form did it take? And overwhelmingly, 90% of the responses came from women who said they had been gaslit in a medical situation, either prior to diagnosis or during treatment of their MS. I'm quick to follow up behind and say 75% of male patients also said they had been gaslit.
When we talk about gaslighting, that's a pretty loaded term. I've always thought of gaslighting as describing the deliberate manipulation of an individual, right? What you're describing sounds more like a combination of misdiagnosis, which happens way too often in MS, and what I'll call the lazy practice of medicine. Do you see the kinds of behavior you talk about in the paper as being deliberate on the part of the physician?
I think it's an excellent point. And I think Gavin and I went back and forth. Should we call it medical gaslighting? Is symptom dismissal more appropriate? I think, it's a headline. It's a big grabby headline. But on the other hand, I think that very few healthcare professionals actually do it intentionally. I just think it's a combination of factors. As you said, MS is an incredibly complex disease. It's a number of symptoms. How can you ask a patient, or one patient's response might be, I'm tired. But that meaning they say nap 2 hours a day, whereas another would say, I've got a full-time job and I go to bed at 9 o'clock at night. So many different variances. And also, I think there's huge pressures also on healthcare professionals. The time is limited. They've got huge demands. So sometimes it is difficult to separate whether or not they're giving the full attention. I think there's so much involved in that term. But I think it's probably a good thing to raise awareness of it, because I think we all do come with unconscious biases, and just being aware of that.
Well, I think regardless of what we want to call it, I think we can also appreciate the frustration a patient experiences when they, leave a doctor's office feeling as though they haven't been heard. So how do we fix this scenario so it doesn't keep occurring?
Well, that's a really good question, because I think I'll answer for more of the patient point, and also maybe sort of thread in about the healthcare professional. But I think the patient point should realize this is usually it's a very limited time period to come in with, say, a list. You say around 3 or 4 points, if that's possible, what your issues or what your symptoms are, and how does it personally affect you? Does that mean suddenly that you are unable to go to work if you, say, complain of tiredness, or you're always forgetting things? So try and personalize it and give examples. Ask the doctor what they can do to help. Also, I do know if you are being concerned, bring along a support, bring along a friend or family member, because sometimes they're so much better at listening. And also, I know in some cases it's slightly tricky. You might want to ask your healthcare professional just to make sure you get everything to record the session. Sometimes that does that, so you don't miss anything. If you do have any concerns, I do think you can go to a higher body, or if worse comes to worse, get a second opinion, or perhaps change your healthcare provider. From the healthcare professional side, it's very difficult for me to sort of suggest, but just possibly be aware maybe of your unconscious biases, and maybe just do a bit more or reading or to find out how MS can affect different genders, and also different people from different cultural and ethnic backgrounds, because I think that's something which has been overlooked.
No, I think you're exactly right. I think it's a tricky thing. I can think of a situation. Patient comes into the office and says, fatigue, it's really getting in the way. I can't do the things I need to do. Help me. There aren't a lot of good solutions to fatigue. So that patient ends up perhaps feeling a little bit frustrated. Did they feel that they weren't heard? Did they feel that they weren't treated?
Yeah, I think I absolutely agree with you. And also, I think they are in the healthcare professional setting. And if they turn around and perhaps the doctor might, or the nurse or the therapist might say to you, we can possibly offer you a sort of drug. And they say, look, I don't want to take any more drugs, or might offer, you know, exercise or things like that. It really is a minefield. But I do think it's something that is worth discussing, because I think it does exist. And especially in MS, where it's such a difficult disease, and it's so difficult to get a diagnosis, because we know we just don't have one, you know, set biomarker.
Right. And I think that's why everybody appreciates you shining a bright light on this and bringing some awareness to it. Rachel Horn, thank you for your efforts to honor the outstanding research contributions that are being made by women, as well as your steadfast advocacy on behalf of everyone affected by MS. And thanks for talking with me today.
Thank you very much, John. And I hope you've had a successful Milan 2023.
Well, thank you. Also joining me is the first recipient of the Rachel Horn Prize for Women's Research in MS, Dr. Rhonda Voskuhl. Dr. Voskuhl is a neurologist, research scientist, and clinician at the University of California in Los Angeles, where Dr. Voskuhl is a professor of neurology, the Jack H. Skirball Chair for Multiple Sclerosis Research, and the director of the UCLA Multiple Sclerosis Program. Congratulations on being named the very first recipient of this award, and thanks for joining me, Dr. Voskuhl.
Thank you so much, John. So happy to be here and just be able to say how thankful and grateful I am to Rachel Horn for creating this prize. It's going to go on for year after year, and I think it's going to make a big difference for women's health in MS.
This award acknowledges the work you've accomplished throughout your career, really, to better understand the role of estrogens and X chromosome genes in MS. I don't believe that anyone can even begin to have a conversation about how MS affects men and women differently without referencing your work. How did you first become interested in exploring how and why MS affects men and women differently?
Well, I've always been one of these people that, even in medical school, when they would tell me that something's a certain way, I would always say, well, why? And they would say, well, I don't know. That's just the way that it is. So that always kind of bothered me. And that happened for sure, you know, with multiple sclerosis. So you see, clearly, it's been known for many, many decades that women have MS more often than men do. And then I know when I was working at the NIH, we did experiments even on mice that was the preclinical model of MS. And sure enough, the female mice were all getting sick and the males weren't getting sick. And I said, that's interesting, because we could potentially figure this out, because we have things that we can do experimentally on mice that are just so easy to do, you know, honestly, looking at sex chromosomes, sex hormones, and so forth. And I did meet a little bit of resistance. They said, oh, well, don't pay attention to that. You know, we have a different question. Just order the female mice and go on with your work. And I said, well, can I just order the males too and kind of compare them and see what's going on differently in them? Because, you know, what I honestly believe is this is a gift. It's an invaluable clue into a major disease modifier. There is something that makes women more susceptible that obviously should be blocked, or there's something that's making males a little bit more protected to getting the disease in the first place, and that's something that you would want to also expound upon. So I see these things as really obvious disease modifiers that are just being overlooked for, I don't know why, but wow, I just want to embrace them instead of run away from them.
You hit it on the head. Rachel mentioned it. We all say it. Oh, MS affects women three times more than men. But on the other hand, do we stop and say, how come? So thank you for raising the question loud enough for people to hear it. So as MS progresses across the lifespan, does it continue to affect men and women differently?
That's another thing that really intrigues me about MS. It's a terrible disease, and it's extraordinarily complicated. But it's also complicated in its sex difference, in the sense that women are more susceptible, the more likely to get MS, and probably it's because they have a more robust immune system. They also get lupus more often. They get rheumatoid arthritis more often. And so I want to see the common thread in all these things. That said, it's so amazing that despite being more susceptible to getting MS, women actually don't do worse. Men do worse with their disability progression, at least for a while. We'll get into that in a minute. But it's just counterintuitive that, you know, women would be more likely to get MS, and then women wouldn't do worse after they get it. So I said, well, why would that be? And so we began to split apart these effects of maybe a sex chromosome, an X chromosome gene to be specific, promoting disease in females and women, and that could lead to the increased susceptibility. In contrast, when you start to think about things with respect to disability progression, that's another ball game. We're not talking about anti-inflammatories and things like that. All of a sudden, we're starting to talk about, we should be always talking about, in my view, for a decade, we've been thinking about this, and that is there's a difference in the immune response and the ability and getting MS, getting relapses, actually, on the one hand, versus mechanisms in the brain. Your resilience to that attack, that immune attack, and it, can it differ between females and males? And we've shown that it does. People know in MS that men who are generally in their early 40s, that's a particular time period up until 35 to 50, mean age of around 40, those men actually do worse in their progression. That means they're having a more neurodegenerative response. There's something going on with the brain cells that is bad. It's worse in men than in women. So we also have been focused on trying to figure that out. And the other third point I think that's so intriguing is that, yes, women do better and they're more resilient to this neurodegeneration and disability accumulation up until menopause. And then all of a sudden, women do worse. Their disabilities worsen. So this is another huge clue. There must be something protective in women. And guess what? It lasts until about 50. And so, lo and behold, we're starting to think a lot about estrogens. And they had been known to be neuroprotective for decades, actually in a lot of different diseases and systems and aging and so forth. So very interested in the pro-inflammatory effect of an X chromosome in women and how that can be countered for a while up until menopause with protecting the brain, some resilience that some men don't have. They don't have that kind of resilience. But boy, what happens when you lose the estrogen too? Now you've got the X chromosome promoting, you've lost your estrogen protection, and that's really bad.
Here at ECTRIMS, you participated in a little bit of a debate arguing in favor of all women with MS starting hormone replacement therapy at menopause, unless it's contraindicated. Can you tell me about that?
I thought it was a great debate. I thought it was a great question. And I really want to say thank you to ECTRIMS for putting it forward. I just think this is something that is a question that comes to neurologists and patients in the clinic literally every week. If you ask neurologists, the women are asking about this. They may ask their female neurologist more than they do their male neurologist. And that is, what do I do? My MS is getting worse. And I'm going through menopause. And what do you mean it's getting worse? Well, it's not that they're having new relapses. They're not having enhancing lesions. It's their pre-existing MS symptoms are getting slowly worse. And it's happening and aligning with menopause. Now, they're very concerned about it. And the first thing is the answer is not to escalate them to a more aggressive anti-inflammatory because they're not having enhancing lesions. This is not the mechanism. You shouldn't be focusing on things that they have a little more inflammation. What they need is to go back to having that estrogen-mediated neuroprotection. So, to that end, we became very interested in estrogen treatment of menopausal women, and the subject of the debate was, should all MS women be put on HRT, if not otherwise contraindicated? That's what you were just asking, and it's a complicated question, I know you're at the debate, because I know you, that you would be there, but it was really interesting how we both agreed, actually, with each other. It was for and against, but we agreed, and what's and I think it's nice to have people come to a consensus, because it creates a strong message that this is the consensus from both sides. And what are the two sides? Well, one is my side, which was menopause is bad. It's bad in healthy women. They have cognitive decline. They have particular areas of brain atrophy. They have particular cognitive domain issues. And of course, when you overlay that onto MS, it makes it even worse. And not just cognition, but the other disabilities that they have. So clearly menopause is bad. So the question is, how can we let this drop in estrogen occur with aging and do nothing about it? We know that this is causing a problem, and yet we don't have a solution, and that is really the problem. And the reason we don't have a solution is because we still use drugs like Premarin or estradiol. These things have been around for so long, and we've known for a long time that they don't really improve cognition or prevent brain atrophy. And so the question is, why in the world haven't we created better treatments? So I would agree with my person who said, should all women be treated with HRT? And I would say, well, no, they shouldn't, because estradiol has risks associated with it. It binds to ER alpha, which is in the breast, and breast cancer is very relatively common. It's a terrible disease. You know, we take tamoxifen to block ER alpha. And so, no, we shouldn't be taking estradiol. And, you know, if they can, the GYNs will only treat for a low dose and for 5 years, then you can't take it anymore. So then you're left with, what are you going to do? So what we've done is we've focused on developing a better estrogen. And that estrogen is one that binds ER beta, not ER alpha. So it doesn't promote breast cancer the way that the estradiol does. The other thing that we've done is we've shown that we've given it in aging and also in the MS models, and we've shown that it can bind ER beta in brain cells, astrocytes, oligodendrocytes, and microglia to reduce inflammation and cause remyelination. This is what we need to do. We need to have a better estrogen, and it should be either estriol, which is naturally occurring, the estrogen of pregnancy, which we know pregnancy is good. Well, guess what? Lo and behold, it can be used as a treatment, and we've done this in trials, giving a pregnancy dose of estrogen. And 10 years from now, we should have a novel estrogen receptor beta ligand that binds only ER beta and zero alpha. But right now, we have a pretty good one in natural estriol that binds ER beta well above ER alpha. It's called a weak estrogen because it binds ER alpha weakly. Well, that's actually a good thing, and you can still see neuroprotection with it. So this is really standard practice for pharmacologic development. You basically, the saponamides were all based on that kind of a philosophy. And actually, let's think about the interferons. You know, gamma interferon doesn't work. We don't throw it all away. No, we go to alpha beta interferon and we develop it. We also know the dose works. So when some of the low doses don't work in these retrospective data that they look at for HRT, well, no, they don't work because they used a really low dose or they used intermittent doses. They didn't even give it every day. This certain weeks they were given different things. And so we know from the interferons that high doses work better than low doses. And the other thing we know is timing matters. And so some of the studies in the Women's Health Initiatives for neurodegeneration and dementia, they were giving it to women who are 72 years old. Well, we know with MS, early treatment is better. It's also true with all kinds of things, right? So, you know, we need to have a better estrogen that binds beta instead of alpha. We need to treat early, not late. And we need to have an estrogen that we can actually give at a reasonably high dose and not have these off-target effects.
Well, Rhonda Voskuhl, thank you for all you continue to do to help us better understand how MS impacts women and men. Congratulations on being the first recipient of the Rachel Horn Prize for Women's Research in MS. And thanks for talking with me today.
Thank you so much, John. Thank you for everything you do for MS patients.
That's going to wrap up this episode of Real Talk MS. Real Talk MS is powered by the National MS Society. And you can share this episode of the podcast by letting your friends or family members know that all they have to do is point their web browser at realtalkms.com/322. You'll find that link in today's show notes, so you can easily copy and paste it right into an email or text. And if you have a minute, I hope you'll visit the Apple App Store or the Google Play Store and download the free Real Talk MS app for your iOS or Android smartphone or tablet. It's the best way for us to stay connected. The app will automatically download the latest episode of Real Talk MS. You'll be able to access any of our past episodes. You'll be able to save your favorite episodes. And it's a great way for me to share bonus content with you. The app is free. So I hope you'll download it today. I'm John Strum. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and make healthy choices.